This is Audible.
Hachette Audio presents The Lost City of the Monkey God, a true story, written by Douglas Preston, read by Bill Mumy, includes a Mac and PC compatible PDF of bonus material.
Chapter 1. The Gates of Hell. Deep in Honduras, in a region called La Mosquitia, lie some of the last unexplored places on Earth. Mosquitia is a vast, lawless area covering about 32,000 square miles, a land of rainforests, swamps, lagoons, rivers, and mountains. Early maps labeled it the Portal del Infierno, or Gates of Hell, because it was so forbidding. The area is one of the most dangerous in the world, for centuries frustrating efforts to penetrate and explore it. Even now, in the 21st century, hundreds of square miles of the Mosquitia rainforest remain scientifically untouched. In the heart of Mosquitia, the thickest jungle in the world carpets relentless mountain chains, some a mile high, cut by steep ravines with lofty waterfalls and roaring torrents. Deluged with over 10 feet of rain a year, the terrain is regularly swept by flash floods and landslides. It has pools of quick mud that can swallow a person alive. The understory is infested with deadly snakes, jaguars, and thickets of cat-claw vines with hooked thorns that tear at flesh and clothing. In Mosquitia, an experienced group of explorers, well-equipped with machetes and saws, can expect to journey 2 to 3 miles in a brutal 10-hour day. The dangers of exploring Mosquitia go beyond the natural deterrence. Honduras has one of the highest murder rates in the world. 80% of the cocaine from South America destined for the United States is shipped through Honduras, most of it via Mosquitia. Drug cartels rule much of the surrounding countryside and towns. The State Department currently forbids U.S. government personnel from traveling into Mosquitia and the surrounding state of Gracias a Dios due to credible threat information against U.S. citizens. This fearful isolation has wrought a curious result. For centuries, Mosquitia has been home to one of the most persistent and tantalizing legends. Somewhere in this impassable wilderness, it is said, lies a lost city built of white stone. It is called Ciudad Blanca, the White City, also referred to as the Lost City of the Monkey God. Some have claimed the city is Maya, while others have said an unknown and now vanished people built it thousands of years ago. On February 15, 2015, I was in a conference room in the Hotel Papabeto in Catacamas, Honduras, taking part in a briefing. In the following days, our team was scheduled to helicopter into an unexplored valley known only as Target 1, deep in the interior mountains of Mosquitia. The helicopter would drop us off on the banks of an unnamed river, and we would be left on our own to hack out a primitive camp in the rainforest. This would become our base as we explored what we believed to be the ruins of an unknown city. We would be the first researchers to enter that part of Mosquitia. None of us had any idea what we would actually see on the ground, shrouded in dense jungle, in a pristine wilderness that had not seen human beings in living memory. Night had fallen over Catacamas. The expedition's logistics chief, standing at the head of the briefing room, was an ex-soldier named Andrew Wood, who went by the name of Woody. Formerly a sergeant major in the British SAS and a soldier in the Coldstream Guards, Woody was an expert in jungle warfare and survival. He opened the briefing by telling us his job was simple: to keep us alive. He had called this session to make sure we were aware of the various threats we might encounter in exploring the valley. He wanted all of us, even the expedition's nominal leaders, to understand and agree that his ex-SAS team was in charge for the days we would be in the jungle. This was going to be a quasi-military command structure, and we would follow their orders without cavil. It was the first time our expedition had come together in one room, a rather motley crew of scientists, photographers, film producers, and archaeologists, plus me, a writer. We all had widely varying experience in wilderness skills. Woody went over security, speaking in his clipped British style. We had to be careful even before we entered the jungle. Catacamas was a dangerous city, controlled by a violent drug cartel. No one was to leave the hotel without an armed military escort. We were to keep our mouths shut about what we were doing here. We were not to engage in conversation about the project within hearing of hotel staff, or leave papers lying around our rooms referring to the work, or conduct cell phone calls in public. There was a large safe available in the hotel storage room for papers, money, maps, computers, and passports. As for the hazards we would face in the jungle, venomous snakes were at the top of the list. The fur de lance, he said, is known in these parts as the Barba amarilla, yellow beard. Herpetologists consider it the ultimate pit viper. It kills more people in the New World than any other snake. It comes out at night and is attracted to people and activity. It is aggressive, irritable, and fast. Its fangs have been observed to squirt venom for more than 6 feet, and they can penetrate even the thickest leather boot. Sometimes it will strike, and then pursue and strike again. It often leaps upward as it strikes, hitting above the knee. The venom is deadly. If it doesn't kill you outright through a brain hemorrhage, it may very well kill you later through sepsis. If you survive, the limb that was struck often has to be amputated due to the necrotizing nature of the poison. We were, Woody said, going into an area where choppers cannot fly at night or in weather. Evacuation of a snakebite victim might be delayed for days. He told us to wear our Kevlar snake gaiters at all times, including, especially, when we got up to pee at night. He warned us always to step on top of a log and then down. We should never put our foot down on the blind side. This was how his friend Steve Rankin, Bear Grylls' producer, was bitten when they were in Costa Rica scouting a location for a show. Even though Rankin was wearing snake gaiters, the fur de lance, which was hiding under the far side of the log, hit him on his boot below the protection. The fangs went through the leather like butter. And here's what happened, Woody said, taking out his iPhone. He passed it around. It displayed a terrifying picture of Rankin's foot afterward, as it was being operated on. Even with anti-venom treatment, the foot necrotized and the dead flesh had to be debrided down to tendons and bone. Rankin's foot was saved, but a piece of his thigh had to be transplanted to cover up the gaping wound. The valley, Woody continued, appeared to be an ideal habitat for the fur de lance. I snuck a glance at my compatriots. The convivial atmosphere of the group earlier in the day, beers in hand around the hotel pool, had evaporated. Next came a lecture on the disease-bearing insects we might encounter, including mosquitoes and sandflies, chiggers, ticks, kissing bugs, so-called because they like to bite your face, scorpions and bullet ants, whose bite equals the pain of being shot with a bullet. Perhaps the ghastliest disease endemic to Mosquitia is mucocutaneous leishmaniasis, sometimes called white leprosy, caused by the bite of an infected sandfly. The Leishmania parasite migrates to the mucous membranes of the victim's nose and lips and eats them away, eventually creating a giant weeping sore where the face used to be. He emphasized that it was important to apply DEET from head to toe on a regular basis, spray our clothing with it, and thoroughly cover up after dusk. We heard about scorpions and spiders climbing into our boots at night, which we were to store upside down on stakes driven into the ground and shake out every morning. He spoke of vicious red ants that swarmed in the understory and which, at the slightest tremble of a branch, would shower down like rain, getting into our hair, going down our necks, and biting like mad, injecting a toxin that would require an immediate evacuation. Look carefully, he warned, before placing your hand on any branch, stem, or tree trunk. Don't push willy-nilly through dense vegetation. In addition to hiding insects and tree-climbing snakes, many plants sport thorns and spikes that can draw blood. We should wear gloves while in the jungle, preferably the scuba kind, which do a better job preventing the entry of spines. He warned us how easy it was to get lost in the jungle, often a matter of wandering a mere 10 or 15 feet from the group. Under no circumstances would anyone ever be allowed to leave camp on his or her own or detach from the group while in the bush. On every trip we took from the base camp, he said, we would be required to carry a backpack with a kit of emergency supplies, food, water, clothing, DEET, flashlight, knife, matches, rain gear, under the assumption that we would get lost and be forced to spend the night sheltering under some dripping log. We were issued whistles, and as soon as we thought we might be lost, we were to stop, blow a distress signal, and wait to be fetched. I paid attention. I really did. From the safety of the conference room, it seemed clear that Woody was simply trying to scare us into line, offering an excess of caution for those expedition members inexperienced in wilderness conditions. I was one of only 3 people in the room who had actually flown over Target 1, the exceedingly remote valley we were headed into. From the air, it looked like a sun-dappled tropical paradise, not the dangerous, dank disease and snake-infested jungle Woody was picturing. We would be fine. Chapter 2. I can tell you only that it is somewhere in the Americas. I first heard the legend of the White City in 1996 when I was on assignment from National Geographic to write a story about the ancient temples of Cambodia. NASA had recently flown a DC-10 carrying an advanced radar system over various jungle areas of the world to determine if the radar could penetrate the foliage to reveal what lay hidden beneath. The results were analyzed at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, California, by a team of experts in remote sensing. That is, analyzing images of the Earth taken from space. After crunching the data, the team found the ruins of a previously unknown 12th-century temple hidden in the Cambodian jungle. I met with the team's leader, Ron Blom, to find out more. Blom was not your stereotypical scientist. He was bearded, rugged, fit, with aviator glasses and an Indiana Jones hat. He had gained international fame for discovering the lost city of Ubar in the Arabian Desert. When I asked Blom what other projects he was working on, he rattled off a number of missions. Mapping the frankincense trade routes across the Arabian Desert, tracking the old Silk Road, and mapping Civil War sites in Virginia. He explained that by combining digitized images in different wavelengths of infrared light and radar, and then beating up on the data with computers, they were now able to see 15 feet beneath desert sands, peer through jungle canopies, and even cancel out modern tracks and roads, revealing ancient trails. Ancient trails were interesting, but I was particularly enthralled by the idea that this technology might be able to discover other lost cities like Ubar. And when I asked him about that, Blom suddenly became evasive. Let me just say we are looking at other sites. Scientists are terrible at deception. I knew immediately he was covering up something big. I pressed further. And finally he admitted that it could be a very major site, but I can't talk about it. I'm working for a private party. I've signed a non-disclosure agreement. It's based on legends of a lost city. I can tell you only that it's somewhere in the Americas. The legends suggested a general area, and we're using satellite data to locate targets. Have you found it? I can't say more than that. Who are you working with? I can't reveal that information. Blom agreed to pass on my interest to his mysterious employer and ask him or her to call me. He couldn't promise that the person would be in touch. Inflamed with curiosity about the possible identity of this lost city, I called up several Central American archaeologists I knew, who offered their own speculations. David Stewart, then assistant director of the Corpus of Maya Hieroglyphic Inscriptions Project at Harvard's Peabody Museum, and one of those who contributed to the decipherment of Mayan glyphs, told me, "I know the area pretty well. Some of it is almost unexplored by archaeologists. Local people were always telling me about sites they'd see while hunting out in the forest. Big ruins with sculptures. Many of these stories are true. These people have no reason to lie." In Mayan texts themselves, he added, there are also tantalizing references to major cities and temples that are not correlated with any known sites. It is one of the last areas on Earth where an actual pre-Columbian city could be hidden, untouched for centuries. The Harvard Mayanist Gordon Willey, now deceased, immediately brought up the legend of the White City. "I remember when I was down in Honduras in 1970, there was talk of a place called Ciudad Blanca, the White City, back in there away from the coast. It was bar talk from the usual random bullshitters, and I thought it was probably some limestone cliffs. Nevertheless, Willie was intrigued enough to want to check it out. But I never could get a permit to go in there. The Honduran government rarely issued archaeological permits to explore that backcountry jungle because it is so perilous." A week later, Blom's employer did call me. His name was Steve Elkins, and he described himself as a cinematographer, a curious man, an adventurer. He wanted to know why the hell I was interrogating Blom. I said I wanted to do a short New Yorker piece about his search for this legendary lost city, whatever it was. He grudgingly agreed to talk, but only if I didn't identify the site or the country it was in. Off the record, he finally admitted that they were indeed looking for Ciudad Blanca, the White City, also known as the Lost City of the Monkey God. But he didn't want me to reveal any of this in my New Yorker piece until he'd had a chance to confirm it on the ground. "Just say it's a lost city somewhere in Central America. Don't say it's in Honduras or we're screwed." Elkins had heard the legends, both indigenous and European, about the White City that described an advanced and wealthy city with extensive trading networks deep in the inaccessible mountains of Mosquitia, untouched for centuries, as pristine as the day it was abandoned. It would be an archaeological discovery of enormous significance. We thought that by using space imagery, we could locate a target area and identify promising sites for later ground exploration. Blom and his team had zeroed in on an area about a mile square, which he had labeled Target 1, or T1 for short, where there appeared to be large man-made structures. Elkins refused to elaborate. "I can't tell you any more, because this space imaging data can be purchased by anybody. Anybody could do what we did and grab the credit. It could also be looted. All we have left to do is go there, which we plan to do this spring. By then," he added, "we hope we'll have something to announce to the world." Chapter 3. The devil had killed him for daring to look upon this forbidden place. "Most Sacred Majesty, I have trustworthy reports of very extensive and rich provinces, and of powerful chiefs ruling over them. I ascertained that it lies 8 or 10 days' march from that town of Trujillo, or rather between 50 and 60 leagues. So wonderful are the reports about this particular province that even allowing largely for exaggeration, it will exceed Mexico in riches and equal it in the largeness of its towns and villages, the density of its population, and the policy of its inhabitants. In the year 1526, Cortes penned this report, his famous fifth letter to the Emperor Charles V, while aboard his ship anchored in Trujillo Bay, off the coast of Honduras. Historians and anthropologists believe this account, written 6 years after Cortes's conquest of Mexico, planted the seeds for the myth of Ciudad Blanca, the city of the monkey god. Given that Mexico, i.e. the Aztec Empire, had staggering wealth and a capital city of at least 300,000 inhabitants, his assertion that the new land was even greater is remarkable. The Indians called it the Old Land of Red Earth, he wrote, and his vague description placed it somewhere in the mountains of Mosquitia. But at the time, Cortes was embroiled in intrigue and had to fight off rebellion by his subordinates, so he never did embark on a search for the Old Land of Red Earth. The jagged mountains, clearly visible from the bay, may have convinced him that such a journey would be daunting. Nevertheless, his story took on a life of its own, much as tales of El Dorado persisted in South America for centuries. 20 years after the fifth letter, a missionary named Cristobal de Pedraza, who would become the first bishop of Honduras, claimed to have traveled deep into the jungles of Mosquitia on one of his arduous missionary journeys, where he came across an astonishing sight. From a high bluff, he found himself looking down on a large and prosperous city spread out in a river valley. His Indian guide told him the nobles in that land took their meals from plates and goblets of gold. Pedraza was not interested in gold, however, and he continued on and never entered the valley. But his subsequent report to Charles V fed the legend. For the next 300 years, geographers and travelers told stories about ruined cities in Central America. In the 1830s, a New Yorker named John Lloyd Stevens became obsessed with finding those cities deep in the Central American rainforest, if indeed they existed. He managed to wrangle a diplomatic appointment as ambassador to the short-lived Federal Republic of Central America. He arrived in Honduras in 1839, just as the Republic was falling apart into violence and civil war. Amid the chaos, he saw an opportunity, albeit a dangerous one, to strike out on his own to seek out these mysterious ruins. He brought with him a superb British artist, Frederick Catherwood, who packed a camera lucida in order to project and copy every tiny detail of whatever they might find. The two trekked for weeks through Honduras with native guides, pursuing rumors of a great city. Deep in the interior, they finally arrived at a miserable, unfriendly, mosquito-ridden village on the banks of a river called Copan, near the Guatemalan border. They learned from the locals that across the river there were indeed ancient temples, inhabited only by monkeys. As they reached the riverbank, they saw on the far shore a wall of cut stone. After fording the river on muleback, they climbed a staircase and entered the city. "We ascended by large stone steps," Stevens wrote later, "in some places perfect, and in others thrown down by trees which had grown up between the crevices, and reached a terrace, the form of which it was impossible to make out from the density of the forest in which it was enveloped. Our guide cleared a way with his machete, and working our way through the thick woods, we came upon a square stone column. The front was the figure of a man, curiously and richly dressed, and the face, evidently a portrait, solemn, stern, and well fitted to excite terror. The back was of a different design, unlike anything we had ever seen before, and the sides were covered with hieroglyphics." Up to this moment of discovery, the image most North Americans carried of Indians came from the hunter-gatherer tribes they had read about or encountered along the frontier. Most viewed the aboriginal inhabitants of the New World as half-naked savage Indians who had never achieved anything approaching what was termed civilization. Stevens' explorations changed all that. It was an important moment in history when the world realized that stupendous civilizations had arisen independently in the Americas. He wrote, "The sight of this unexpected monument put at rest at once and forever in our minds all uncertainty in regard to the character of American antiquities, proving, like newly discovered historical records, that the people who once occupied the continent of America were not savages. The people, named the Maya, who had built this sprawling city of pyramids and temples, and who had covered their monuments with hieroglyphic writing, had created a civilization as advanced as any in Old World antiquity. Stevens, a fine enterprising American, promptly bought the ruins of Copan for $50 from the local landowner and made plans, later abandoned, to have the buildings disassembled, loaded on barges, and floated to the United States for a tourist attraction. Over the next few years, Stevens and Catherwood explored, mapped, and recorded ancient Mayan cities from Mexico to Honduras. They never did venture into Mosquitia, however, perhaps deterred by mountains and jungles far more discouraging than anything they had experienced in the Maya realm. They published a 2-volume work about their discoveries, Incidents of Travel in Central America, Chiapas, and Yucatan, packed with exciting stories of ruins, bandits, and brutal jungle travel, and lavishly illustrated with Catherwood's splendid engravings. Their book went on to become one of the biggest nonfiction bestsellers of the entire 19th century. Americans were thrilled by the idea that the New World had cities, temples, and colossal antiquities that rivaled those of the Old World, equal to the pyramids of Egypt and the glories of ancient Rome. The work of Stevens and Catherwood established the romance of lost cities in the American mind and introduced the notion that the jungles of Central America must hold many more secrets waiting to be revealed. Before long, the Maya became one of the most intensely studied ancient cultures in the New World, and not just by secular scientists. The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints identified the Maya as one of the lost tribes of Israel, the Lamanites, as chronicled in the Book of Mormon, published in 1830. The Lamanites left Israel and sailed to America around 600 BC. The Book of Mormon tells the story that Jesus appeared to the New World Lamanites and converted them to Christianity, and it describes many events that occurred before the coming of the Europeans. In the 20th century, the Mormon Church sent a number of well-funded archaeologists to Mexico and Central America to try to confirm the stories through site excavations. Although this resulted in valuable, high-quality research, it also proved difficult for the scientists themselves. Facing clear evidence that disproved the Mormon view of history, some of the archaeologists ended up losing their faith, and a few of those who voiced their doubts were excommunicated. The Maya realm, which stretched from southern Mexico to Honduras, seemed to end at Copan. The vast jungled mountains east of Copan, especially in Mosquitia, were so inhospitable and dangerous that very little exploration and even less archaeology took place. Glimpses of other non-Maya pre-Columbian cultures were being uncovered eastward of Copan, but these vanished societies also remained elusive and poorly studied. Just how far east and south of Copan the Maya influence stretched was also difficult to ascertain. In the vacuum, tantalizing rumors grew of even greater, wealthier cities, perhaps Maya, perhaps not, hidden in those impenetrable thickets, stories that fascinated archaeologists and treasure hunters alike. By the dawn of the 20th century, these stories and rumors had coalesced into a single legend of a sacred and forbidden Ciudad Blanca, a rich cultural treasure yet to be found. The name probably originated with the Peck Indians, also known as the Paya of Mosquitia. Anthropologists collected stories from Peck informants of a Caja Camasa, a white house, said to lie beyond a pass in the mountains at the headwaters of two rivers. Some Indians described it as a refuge where their shamans retreated to escape the invading Spaniards, never to be seen again. Others said that the Spanish did, in fact, enter the White City, but were cursed by the gods and died or vanished into the forest, lost forever. Yet other Indian stories described it as a tragic city that was struck down by a series of catastrophes. The inhabitants, seeing that the gods were angry with them, abandoned the city. Forever after, it became a forbidden place, and anyone who entered it would die of sickness or be killed by the devil. There were also American versions of the legend. Various explorers, prospectors, and early aviators spoke of glimpsing the limestone ramparts of a ruined city rising above the jungle foliage somewhere in central Muskegon. It seems likely that all these stories, indigenous, Spanish, and American, were conflated to form the basis of the White City or Monkey God legend. Although many explorers had traveled into the Central American rainforests in the wake of Stephen's discoveries, almost none had ventured into the daunting terrain of Mosquitia. In the 1920s, a Luxembourgian ethnologist, Edward Conzemius, became one of the first Europeans to explore Mosquitia, traveling by dugout canoe up the Platano River. On this trip, he had heard tell of important ruins discovered by a rubber tapper 20 to 25 years ago when he was lost in the bush between the Platano and Paulea rivers. Conzemius reports, "This man gave a fantastical description of what he saw there. They were the ruins of a most important city, with white stone buildings similar to marble, surrounded by a large wall of the same material. But shortly after the rubber tapper reported his discovery, he disappeared." One Indian told Conzemius that the devil had killed him for daring to look upon this forbidden place. When Conzemius tried to hire a guide to take him to the White City, the Indians feigned ignorance, fearful, he was told, that if they revealed the location, they would die. By the beginning of the 1930s, the growing legend attracted the attention of American archaeologists and major institutions, who considered it not only possible, but even likely, that the unexplored mountainous jungles along the Maya frontier could be hiding a ruined city, or perhaps even a lost civilization. It might be Maya, or it might be something entirely new. In the early 1930s, the Smithsonian's Bureau of American Ethnology sent a professional archaeologist to explore eastward of Copan to see if Maya civilization extended into the rugged thickets of Mosquitia. William Duncan Strong was a scholar, a man ahead of his time, quiet, careful, and meticulous in his work, averse to spectacle and publicity. He was among the first to establish that Mosquitia had been inhabited by an ancient unknown people who were not Maya. Strong spent 5 months traversing Honduras in 1933, going by dugout canoe up the Rio Patuca and several of its tributaries. He kept an illustrated journal, which is preserved in the Smithsonian's collections, packed with detail and many fine drawings of birds, artifacts, and landscapes. Strong found major archaeological sites, which he carefully described and sketched in his journal, and conducted a few test excavations. Among these finds were the Floresta Mounds, the ancient cities of Huancabila and Dos Quebradas, and the Brown Site. His journey was not without adventure. At one point, his finger was shot off. The exact circumstances are unclear. He may have accidentally shot it off himself. He battled rain, insects, venomous snakes, and dense jungle. What Strong realized right away was that these were not Maya cities. The Maya built with stone, while this region had been extensively settled by a separate, sophisticated culture that built great earthen mounds. This was an entirely new culture. Even as Strong's work showed definitively that Mosquitia was not part of the Maya realm, however, his discoveries raised more questions than they answered. Who were these people? Where had they come from? And why had all record of them vanished until now? How in the world did they manage to live and farm in such a hostile jungle environment? What was their relationship to their powerful Mayan neighbors? The earthworks posed another enigma. Did these mounds hide buried buildings or tombs? Or were they constructed for some other reason? Even as he uncovered many other ancient wonders, Strong continued to hear stories of the greatest ruin of them all, the White City, which he dismissed as a lovely legend. While sitting on the banks of the Rio Tinto in Mosquitia, an informant told Strong the following story, which he recorded in his journal under an entry entitled The Forbidden City. The Lost City, he wrote, lies on the shores of a lake deep in the mountains to the north, its white ramparts surrounded by groves of orange, lemon, and banana trees. But if one partakes of the forbidden fruit, he will be lost in the hills forever. So goes the tale, Strong wrote, but it would be better to do as an informant's father did, follow the river until it becomes a mere trickle among dark rocks and woods, and then have to turn back. The city would still be there that way. Like the Ciudad Blanca, the forbidden fruit will probably long remain a lure to the curious. All these rumors, legends, and stories set the stage for the next phase. On the one side, obsessive and ill-fated expeditions seeking the lost city. And on the other, the beginnings of serious archaeological research in the same region. Both would help to untangle the mystery of the White City. Chapter 4. A land of cruel jungles within almost inaccessible mountain ranges. Enter George Gustav Hay. Hay's father had made a fortune selling his petroleum business to John D. Rockefeller, and his son would go on to increase that wealth as an investment banker in New York City. But Hay had interests other than money. In 1897, fresh out of college and working on a job in Arizona, Hay came across an Indian woman chewing on her husband's splendid buckskin shirt to kill the lice. On a whim, he bought the lice-ridden garment. The buckskin shirt launched one of the most voracious collecting careers in American history. Hay became obsessed with all things Native American, and he would eventually amass a collection of 1 million pieces. In 1916, he established the Museum of the American Indian on Upper Broadway in New York City to house his collection. In 1990, the museum moved to Washington, D.C., and became part of the Smithsonian. Hay was a gigantic man, 6 feet 4 inches tall, almost 300 pounds, with a billiard ball head and a baby face framed by heavy jowls. He wore a gold watch chain draped across a stout chest and dressed in black suits with a straw boater's hat, cigar protruding from a tiny pursed mouth. He often took buying trips across the country in his limousine, consulting the obituary columns in local papers and inquiring if the dearly departed had left behind any unwanted collections of Indian artifacts. On these trips, he would sometimes put his chauffeur in the back seat and take the wheel himself, driving like a fiend. Hay's obsession expanded to Honduras when a doctor in New Orleans sold Hay a sculpture of an armadillo said to come from Muskisha. This curious and appealing object was carved in basalt with a funny-looking face, an arched back, and only 3 legs so it could stand without wobbling. It is still in the museum's collection. It captivated Hay, and he eventually financed an expedition to the treacherous region in search of more artifacts. He hired an explorer named Frederick Mitchell Hedges, a British adventurer who claimed to have found the Maya city of Lubantin in Belize, where his daughter allegedly discovered the famous crystal Skull of Doom. Mitchell Hedges was the very picture of a dashing British explorer, down to the plummy accent, briar pipe, sunburned visage, and hyphenated last name. Mitchell Hedges explored the fringes of Muskisha in 1930 for Hay, until he was laid low with an attack of malaria and dysentery so severe it left him blind in one eye. When he recovered, he brought out over 1,000 artifacts, along with an amazing story of an abandoned city deep in the mountains, home to a gigantic buried statue of a monkey. The natives, he said, called it the Lost City of the Monkey God. Hay quickly sent Mitchell Hedges back on a new expedition to Muskisha to track down the Lost City, co-financed by the British Museum. Interest in the second expedition was high. Mitchell Hedges declared to the New York Times, Our expedition proposes to penetrate a certain region marked on the maps of today as unexplored. Within my knowledge, the region contains immense ruins never yet visited. The location was somewhere in Muskisha, but the exact position he declared a secret. The region can be described as a land of cruel jungles within almost inaccessible mountain ranges. But on the new expedition, Mitchell Hedges did not go into the interior, perhaps wary of repeating his earlier travails. Instead, he spent most of his time exploring the sand beaches and coastlines of the Bay Islands of Honduras, where he pulled some stone statues from under the water, likely deposited there by coastal erosion. He justified his failure to go back into Muskisha by claiming an even greater discovery. He had found the remains of Atlantis, which he suggested had been the cradle of the American races. He returned with more tales of the lost city of the monkey god, which he had heard on his journeys along the coast. Hay immediately began planning another expedition to Honduras with a new leader, this time wisely bypassing Mitchell Hedges, perhaps because he had begun to suspect, belatedly, that the man was a con artist. The truth was, Mitchell Hedges was a fraud on a spectacular scale. He did not discover Lubantin, and the crystal skull was, much later, revealed as a fake. Yet he succeeded in fooling many contemporaries. Even his obituary in the New York Times would eventually repeat as truth a string of dubious facts that Mitchell Hedges had been peddling for years. That he had received 8 bullet wounds and 3 knife scars. That he fought alongside Pancho Villa, was a secret agent for America during World War I, and searched for sea monsters in the Indian Ocean with Sir Arthur Conan Doyle's son. However, some skeptical archaeologists had dismissed Mitchell Hedges as a charlatan even before his second voyage to Honduras, and afterward they heaped ridicule on his outlandish claims about having found Atlantis. Mitchell Hedges published a book about his experiences, Land of Wonder and Fear, about which one archaeologist wrote, "To me, the wonder was how he could write such nonsense, and the fear how much taller the next yarn would be." For his third expedition into Muskisha, Hay partnered with the National Museum of Honduras and the country's president, who hoped the new venture would help open up the vast Muskisha region to settlement by modern Hondurans. Knowing that such an expansion effort would, regrettably, involve the displacement or even destruction of the indigenous Indians who still lived there, not unlike what had happened in the American West, the government and the National Museum were eager to document the Indians' way of life before they vanished. An important goal of the expedition was, therefore, to do ethnographic as well as archaeological research. Although his intention was to employ a serious professional, once again, Hay betrayed a weakness for swashbuckling men of questionable integrity. The man Hay chose to find his great ruin overrun by dense jungle was a Canadian journalist named R. Stuart Murray. Murray had given himself the title Captain 15 years before, when he involved himself in a shabby revolution in Santo Domingo. In an interview before he departed for Honduras, Murray said, "There's supposedly a lost city I'm going to look for, which the Indians call the City of the Monkey God. They are afraid to go near it, for they believe that anyone who approaches it will, within the month, be killed by the bite of a poisonous snake." Murray led 2 expeditions for Hay into Muskisha, in 1934 and 1935, journeys that became known as the First and Second Honduran Expeditions. In pursuing various tales and descriptions of the lost city of the monkey god, Murray believed he came tantalizingly close to finding it. But again and again, just as he thought he was on the verge of success, he always seemed to be thwarted by jungle, rivers, mountains, and the death of one of his guides. In the archives of the Museum of the American Indian is a photo of Murray on the banks of a river, kneeling next to a row of small metates, or grinding stones, beautifully carved with the heads of birds and animals. On the back of the photo, Murray wrote a message to Hay, These come from the lost city of the monkey god. The Indian who brought them out was bitten by a fer-de-lance in September and died. With him died the secret of the city's location. More when I return. R.S. Murray. Among the many artifacts he brought back were two he believed contained clues to the lost city. A stone with hieroglyphic characters on it, and a small statue of a monkey covering its face with its paws. After the 1935 expedition, Murray moved on to other projects. In 1939, he was invited to be the guest lecturer on the Stella Polaris, the most elegant cruise ship of its day. There he met a young man named Theodore A. Mord, who had been hired to edit the ship's onboard newspaper. The two became friends. Murray regaled Mord with stories of his search for the lost city of the monkey god, while Mord told Murray of his adventures as a journalist covering the Spanish Civil War. When the ship docked in New York, Murray introduced Mord to Hay. "I hunted for that lost city for years," Murray said. "Now it was someone else's turn." Hay immediately engaged Mord to lead the third Honduran expedition into Musquitia, the trip that would finally, he hoped, reveal to the world the lost city of the monkey god. Mord was only 29 years old, but his expedition and its monumental discovery would ring down through history. The American public, already captivated by the story of the lost city of the monkey god, followed it with enormous interest, and the expedition would give further historians and adventurers enigmatic clues to be endlessly debated and argued. If it weren't for Mord and his fateful expedition, the many bizarre and misguided quests for the lost city that littered the decades of the 1950s to the 80s would not have taken place. Without Mord, Steve Elkins would probably not have heard the legend and would never have embarked on his own eccentric search for the lost city of the monkey god. Chapter 5. I'm going back to the city of the monkey god to try to solve one of the few remaining mysteries of the Western world. A handsome man with a pencil mustache, a smooth, high forehead, and slicked back hair, Theodore Mord was born in 1911 in New Bedford, Massachusetts, into a family of old whaling stock. He was a sharp dresser, favoring Palm Beach suits, crisp shirts, and white shoes. He started his journalism career in high school as a sports reporter for the local paper, and then he moved into broadcast journalism as a writer and news commentator for radio. He attended Brown University for a couple of years, and then took a job editing newspapers aboard various cruise ships in the mid-1930s. In 1938, he covered the Spanish Civil War as a correspondent and photographer. At one point, he claimed to have swum a river to cross the front lines between the fascist and Republican camps so that he could cover both sides. Hay was eager for Mord to set off on his expedition as soon as possible, and Mord wasted no time in organizing it. He asked his former university classmate, Lawrence C. Brown, a geologist, to accompany him. In March of 1940, as war was breaking out across Europe, Mord and Brown departed New York for Honduras with 1,000 pounds of equipment and supplies in what Hay officially called the Third Honduran Expedition. 4 months of silence followed. When the two explorers finally emerged from Musquitia, Mord fired off a letter to Hay about the astounding discovery they had made. They had accomplished what no other expedition had been able to do. The news was published in the New York Times on July 12, 1940. City of Monkey God is believed located. Expedition reports success in Honduras exploration. According to the communication received by the Foundation, the Times article read, "The party has established the approximate location of the rumored lost city of the monkey god in an almost inaccessible area between the Paulea and Platano rivers." The American public devoured the story. Mord and Brown arrived back in New York in August to great fanfare. On September 10, 1940, Moore gave a radio interview for CBS. The script still survives, annotated in Moore's hand, and it appears to be the most complete surviving account of their find. "I have just returned from the discovery of a lost city," he told his audience. "We went to a region of Honduras that had never been explored. We spent weeks poling tediously up tangled jungle streams. When we could go no further, we started hacking a path through the jungle. After weeks of that life, we were starved, weak, and discouraged. Then, just as we were about to give up, I saw from the top of a small cliff something that made me stop in my tracks. It was the wall of a city. The lost city of the monkey god. I couldn't tell how large the city was, but I know it extended far into the jungle, and probably 30,000 people once lived there. But that was 2,000 years ago. All that was left were those mounds of earth covering crumbled walls where houses once stood, and stone foundations of what may have been majestic temples. I remembered an ancient legend told by the Indians. It said that in the lost city, a gigantic statue of a monkey was worshipped as a god. I saw a great jungle-covered mound which, when someday we can excavate it, I believe may reveal this monkey deity. Today the Indians near that region fear the very thought of the city of the monkey god. They think it is inhabited by great ape-like hairy men called Ulaks. In creeks near the city we found rich deposits of gold, silver, and platinum. I found a facial mask. It looked like the face of a monkey. On nearly everything was carved the likeness of the monkey god. I'm going back to the city of the monkey god to try to solve one of the few remaining mysteries of the Western world. Moore declined to reveal the location of the city for fear of looting. It seems he kept this information even from Hay himself. In another account written for a magazine, Moore described the ruins in detail. "The city of the monkey god was walled," he wrote. "We found some of those walls upon which the green magic of the jungle had worked small damages and which had resisted the flood of vegetation. We traced one wall until it vanished under mounds that have all the evidence of once being great buildings. There are, indeed, still buildings beneath the age-old shroudings." "It was the ideal spot," he continued. "The towering mountains provided the perfect backdrop. Nearby, a rushing waterfall, beautiful as a sequined evening gown, spilled down into the green valley of ruins. Birds themselves, as brilliant as jewels, flitted from tree to tree, and little monkey faces peered inquisitively at us from the surrounding screen of dense foliage." He questioned the older Indians closely, learning much about the city, handed down to them by their ancestors who had seen it. "We would uncover," they said, "a long-stairred approach to it, which would be built and paved after the manner of the ruined Mayan cities to the north. Stone effigies of monkeys would line this approach. The heart of the temple was a high stone dais on which was the statue of the monkey god himself. Before it was the place of sacrifice." Moore brought back a number of artifacts, figures of monkeys in stone and clay, his canoe, pots, and stone tools. Many of these are still in the collections of the Smithsonian. He vowed that he would return the following year to commence excavation. But World War II intervened. Moore went on to become an OSS spy and war correspondent, and his obituary alleges he was involved in a plot to kill Hitler. He never returned to Honduras. In 1954, Moore, sunken into alcoholism, his marriage failing, hung himself in a shower stall at his parents' summer house in Dartmouth, Massachusetts. He never did reveal the location of the lost city. Moore's account of finding the lost city of the monkey god received wide press and fired the imagination of both Americans and Hondurans. Since his death, The location of his city has been the subject of intense speculation and debate. Dozens have searched for it without success, parsing his writings and accounts for possible clues. One object became the holy grail of searchers, Mord's beloved walking stick, still in the possession of his family. Carved into the stick are four enigmatic columns of numbers that seem to be directions or coordinates. For example, NE-300, E-100, N-250, SE-300. A Canadian cartographer named Derek Parent became obsessed with the markings on the stick and spent years exploring and mapping Mosquitia, trying to use them as directions to the lost city. In the process, Parent created some of the most detailed and accurate maps of Mosquitia ever made. The most recent search for Mord's lost city took place in 2009. A Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist for the Wall Street Journal, Christopher S. Stewart, undertook an arduous journey into the heart of Mosquitia in an attempt to retrace Mord's route. Stewart was accompanied by archaeologist Christopher Begley, who had written his PhD dissertation on Mosquitia's archaeological sites and had visited over 100 of them. Begley and Stewart went upriver and made their way through the jungle to a large ruin called Lance Tilal in the upper reaches of the Rio Platano, which had been built by the same ancient peoples Strong and other archaeologists had identified as once occupying Mosquitia. This previously known city, which had been cleared and mapped by Peace Corps volunteers in 1988, was in the approximate area Mord claimed to be, at least as far as Begley and Stewart could ascertain. It consisted of 21 earthen mounds, defining four plazas and a possible Mesoamerican ball court. In the jungle, some distance behind the ruin, they discovered a white cliff, which Stewart believed might have been mistaken for a broken wall from a distance. He published a well-received book about his search, called Jungle Land, A Mysterious Lost City, A World War II Spy, and A True Story of Deadly Adventure. It is a fascinating read. Yet despite Begley and Stewart's best efforts, there simply wasn't enough evidence to settle the question of whether the Lance Tilal ruins were indeed Mord's lost city of the monkey god. As it turns out, all these researchers have spent almost three-quarters of a century looking for answers in the wrong place. Mord and Brown's journals have been preserved and passed down in Mord's family. While the artifacts were deposited with the Museum of the American Indian, the journals were not. This in itself is a remarkable departure from standard practice, because such journals normally contain vital scientific information and belong to the financing institution, not the explorer. The keeper of the journals until recently was Theodore's nephew, David Mord. I was able to get copies of the journals, which the Mord family had loaned to the National Geographic Society for a few months in 2016. Nobody at National Geographic had read them, but a staff archaeologist kindly scanned them for me because I was writing a story for the magazine. I knew that Christopher Stewart had seen at least parts of them, but had been disappointed to find no clues as to the location of the lost city of the monkey god. He had assumed that Mord, for reasons of security, had withheld that information even from his journals. So when I began flipping through them, I didn't expect to find much worthy of note. There are three journals. Two are hardcover books with dirty canvas covers stamped Third Honduran Expedition, and a third is a smaller spiral book with a black cover labeled Field Notebook. They run to over 300 handwritten pages and give a comprehensive account of the expedition from start to finish. No dates or pages are missing. Every single day was recorded in detail. The journals were the combined work of Brown and Mord, who each made their own entries in the same books as they journeyed into the heart of darkness. Brown's easy-to-read, rounded handwriting alternates with Mord's spiky, forward, slanted style. I'll not soon forget the experience of reading those journals, first with puzzlement, then disbelief, and finally, shock. Hay and the Museum of the American Indian, it seems, were conned, along with the American public. According to their